The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. We've been talking now for several programs about roundworms in general, nematodes in particular. And what I would like to do is to continue looking at some of the unique characteristics of the roundworms. For this reason, here you have a group of organisms, fairly large, 12,000 species plus, that are known, of specimens that are quite different from any other kind of organism that we know. And as we have been observing, this presents some rather unusual difficulties then for the evolutionist, who would try to argue that these have come from common ancestors of one kind or another. And we addressed ourselves to that question earlier, and I will not repeat that. We'd mentioned on the last program one of the unusual characteristics for nematodes is the non-living cuticle. This is a layer of fairly tough tissue. If any of you have had to dissect human roundworms in lab, you're aware of the fact that this outer covering is quite tough. It is made up of collagen, and as we observed on our last program, some of the molecules of collagen are identical with collagen that would be found in humans or other mammals. And we talked about the idea that this is not evidence of any kind of a reproductive relationship. The cuticle, of course, is synthesized, made by the organism itself, but it is not living in the sense that blood cells or muscle cells would be alive. Another of the very unusual characteristics, again unique as far as I'm aware, is the fact that the muscle cells in roundworms run only longitudinally. There are no circular muscles here. And when you look at organisms like the earthworm, for example, or for that matter, the intestinal tract in humans, where you find layers of muscles that are running longitudinally and some in a circular direction, I think the reality is that they are not actually longitudinal. They are simply long curves that are going around the intestinal tract or the body of the earthworm, as opposed to what are referred to as circular muscles, which are much shorter. But they're really not going they're not straight. That need not concern us particularly, but I think that's probably the reality of it. In any case, this arrangement of longitudinal and circular muscle is the basis of peristalsis, the muscular contractions that move food through the intestinal tract in humans. Excuse me. Or the basis of the movement of the earthworm's body. And to find an organism then that does not have the circular muscles is very unusual. If you are under the impression that roundworms can't move, then you haven't seen any of them alive. If you have seen a live roundworm of any sort, they can wiggle unbelievably. But the ability to wiggle apparently is a combination of the longitudinal muscles and the hydrostatic pressure that exists within the coelom, the body cavity of the worm. And I'm not going to attempt to get into an explanation of hydrostatic pressure here. But at any rate, you have only longitudinal muscles. And again, there is no ancestor from which they could have come, and there are no organisms which they would give rise to. So they're simply standing in nature by themselves and without any really good evolutionary explanation for them. To my way of thinking, probably the unique characteristic is what is known as euteley, E-U-T-E-L-Y. This is a condition in which the body is composed of a constant number of cells or nuclei. And as far as I'm aware, this is absolutely unique. I don't know of another organism where that condition exists. The knowledge of it has come from the rather extensive studies that have been done on one species of one of the free-living nematodes. the Xenorhabditis elegans, and this was discovered there. But again, what organism could have given rise to an organism that has that particular characteristic? And there are certainly no other organisms that have descended from it, because it is found only in that particular organism. It is interesting to me that the nematodes do not have any protonephridia. These are glands that are charged with the responsibility of excreting generally protean waste. They are excretory organs, but they simply don't exist in roundworms. Instead, there are simply a few cells that take over that responsibility in roundworms. There are other, I hate to use the word simple here, but other, and I hate to use the word primitive, but other organisms which do have protonephridia. We talked earlier about the fact that organs are possible only in organisms which have all three germ layers, ectoderm, endoderm, and mesoderm. But here you have an organism, fairly complicated, that has all three germ layers, but does not have the protean excretory organs that others would have. The pseudocoel, pseudocoelom, the false cavity, apparently maintains a certain level of hydrostatic pressure, and this is the basis of movement. The combination of that hydrostatic pressure and the ability to contract longitudinal muscles is the thing that gives the roundworms the ability to move vigorously. If you've ever seen a live ascarid, or any of the rest of them for that matter, they just vibrate back and forth almost with their movement. The muscles are unusual, unique, I think. Not the fact that they run only longitudinally, but the structure of the muscles themselves. In our body, the muscles are what are known as syncytia. What this means is that each fiber is going to have many nuclei. If you take a fairly long muscle fiber, such as the sacrospinalis, that runs from the base of the skull down to the pelvic girdle, single muscle fibers are going to have thousands of nuclei, and even the shorter ones are going to have hundreds. And here, the structure of the muscle in nematodes, very, very different. What exists, apparently, is that you have a single muscle cell that basically has two parts to it. You have a single muscle cell that has a fibrillar portion, sometimes it's called the spindle, and it has a non-contractile sarcoplasmic portion known as the cell body. And these are aligned in rather unusual ways. One end of this, the spindle, is going to be next to the hypodermis, the layer underneath the dermis itself. And the cell body is going to be sticking down into the pseudocoelom, which is itself a very unusual and, as far as I am aware, unique arrangement. The spindle is striated. Now, for those of you that know anything about human anatomy, this, the skeletal muscles, the muscles that people are capable of moving, are striated. There are dark and light bands in individual fibers. These bands apparently are, not apparently, these bands are caused, are simply a reflection of the fact that they're composed of two proteins, actin and myosin. And it is the molecular structure of these two proteins which is the basis of the contraction of the muscles, the movement of the muscles. So you have this kind of thing in humans, but you also have the same kind of thing in worms, roundworms at least. And the actual chemical makeup of the actin and myosin is either very similar to or perhaps identical with that which we find in human beings. Now, again, this is not a basis for arguing the fact of the similarity or identical structure in the molecules here is not a basis of arguing. In fact, I don't think the evolutionists would argue that there is relationship here. But we have discussed that before, the fact that there are occasions where similarity is evidence for a relationship. In the case of parents and children, this is the case, because there is a community of genetic material between the parent and the child, and so that's the basis of the similarity. But the evolutionary interpretation of homology involves the idea that wherever you have similarity, this in itself is proof of the relationship. And this is a good example of a situation where that simply can't be true. Even though the molecular structure is the same, there is not the possibility of any kind of a reproductive relationship between roundworms and humans. It is true that there is a great similarity in genetic material. I have read varying figures, but apparently the genetic material of monkeys and man is 90 or 95% identical. This in itself is still not evidence of relationship. We're going to talk about genetics at some point in the future, and when we get to that point, we'll talk about this a little bit. We must not try and evade the fact of the identity of the molecular structure, or in this case, the number of genes that are there. But the question is, is this kind of similarity in itself evidence of a relationship? And we would have to argue, obviously, that it is not, because there simply is not any kind of possibility for reproductive relationship. And this gets us back to the discussion we had earlier involving the idea of common ancestors and missing links and intermediate species. These are mental constructs which the evolutionist has dredged up in an effort to try and provide some kind of persuasive evidence for the notion that wherever you find similar structures, these are evidence of relationship. One of my favorite objections to this has to do with the chela, the pinching claw on an African scorpion, which is identical with the chela on a lobster. And you look at them, and the tempting explanation on the basis of the evolution is, oh, well, here are identical structures. Therefore, there's a relationship. The catch is that the chela are on different appendages, which means there can't be that genetic relationship.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.